We used to have something called a recipe for foods that you couldn't, if you were going to put out pudding or something, it had a recipe, and if you were going to put on it, and if you didn't use that recipe, meaning it had to have cream and eggs or whatever, if you didn't use that recipe, it was called imitation. I mean, you can imagine how much the food industry loved the word imitation, so they did everything they could to get rid of it, and they got rid of it. And the minute they got rid of it, all bets were off. You could take any piece of crap, and you could fortify it with nutrients, and you could call it nutritious.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast, Episode 10. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project, a grassroots farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label that distinguishes soil-grown crops and pasture-raised livestock. You just heard from today's guest, nutritionist and professor Joan Gussow, who was called the matriarch of the Eat Locally, Think Globally movement by the New York Times. Before we dive into the interview, I want to thank you for subscribing and ask you to visit our website, realorganicproject.org, to become one of our 1,000 real fans. Our movement is growing quickly, and if you're interested in keeping real food on your table, we'd love to have your help and support. Now let's get back to the conversation between my co-director, Dave Chapman, and nutritionist, Joan Gussow.
Hello to Joan Di Gussow. Joan has been called the matriarch of the local food movement. She's a longtime professor from Columbia Teachers College. She worked as a researcher for Time Magazine. She's been a mother. She was the chair of the nutrition department and creator of the legendary course, Nutritional Ecology. She's the author of a number of books, The Feeding Web, The Nutrition Debate, Chicken Little, Tomato Sauce and Agriculture, The Organic Life, and finally, Growing Older. I think you might be working on another book.
Growing, comma, older, which is...
Growing, comma, older.
Yes, so thank it's you. About That's growing better, and it's about getting older.
All right. Joan served a five-year term on the National Organic Standards Board for the USDA. She's testified in Congress, and she currently serves on the advisory board of the Real Organic Project. So, Joan, it is a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And how is your next book going?
Don't ask. It's I found COVID so disorienting.
Yeah.
And I also there's this thing you have to ask yourself as you hear all these 21-year-olds running radio programs and talking about people you've never heard of. You have to ask yourself if at 91 you have anything to say that anyone needs to hear. That's the tough part, keeping in mind that you might actually have something to say that anyone wants to hear.
Yeah, well, I'm actually challenged by how we're going to get all this done in an hour, because I think that you still have quite a lot to say that perhaps millions of people would like to hear. So we'll do our best, and if we just can't do it, we'll come back another day.
If it turns out well, I'll just transcribe it and put it out as a book, Dad.
That's right. There's that next book.
Since you think I have so much to say.
Yeah, well, I do think you have a lot to say. Tell me how you got to teach nutrition at Teachers College. What was that evolution like for you?
Well, that's sort of what I've been writing about, actually. It's really interesting because I had absolutely no interest in nutrition as a child. I was actually... My family had a tendency, I have just one sister, my mother and a father, and I grew up in Southern California, and there tended to be a lot of tension at the table, so I was sort of a poor eater, and I was always getting stomach aches and leaving the table. So the fact that I ended up in nutrition is entirely the result of the fact that when I was pregnant with my first child, my brother-in-law, who was interested in health, quote, health foods, as they were called then, this was in the 50s, he sent me Adele Davis's book, Let's Have Healthy Children. And she, in the nutrition profession, is considered a faddist, although she graduated from Berkeley. But she was very much down on the American food supply, and she thought it was very bad, which it was, is. And so I became devoted to her and was asked for advice by my friends and so forth and so on. time passed, people asked me for advice. At one point, one friend's child, he wanted something to eat, and she said, Joan thinks that's lousy, and he said, someone should stop that woman. So I think many people have felt that way since that time, actually. But I finally realized that people were asking me for advice, and I really didn't feel that I knew that much. And so I thought, well, I should go back to school, and I should get a degree in nutrition. And I won't go through the whole thing of how I ended up at teacher's college, but I did, and I ended up getting the degree. And
can I ask what age you were when you got your PhD?
I got an EdD, not a PhD, and I got it in 1975, and I was born in 1928. So that means I was, what does that mean? Almost 50?
Not a kid.
Not a kid. No.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, I've often said that one of the reasons I think I'm still working, I'm still teaching at my age, and I think one of the reasons is that I started so late that when I had done 20 years of my career, I was at the point where most people were retiring, you know, and I was not bored with what I was doing, you know, I hadn't done it that long.
You know, my wife wrote a book on women in mathematics, women mathematicians. My wife taught mathematics for a while, and she was, it was very interesting because the women were so different from the male stereotypes. And one of the things that was different is they often did their work later in life,
yeah,
often after they had had a family. And for the men, all the important work was pretty much done by the time you were 28, and it was all downhill.
Yeah, and
from
by
there.
50, you were certainly done.
you were just about dead. So yeah, that's very interesting. So when I began,
I had early discovered Robert Rodale, and I mean Rodale, not J.I. Rodale, and the Organic Gardening magazine. I took that before I ever went into nutrition, and I was gardening. Not seriously, but I mean, I believed in organics at that time. It made sense to me. So I was always interested in organic. But in my field, I was thinking about this the other day because I was putting together the session of the course, and I realized that when we first started teaching and had a session on organic, I was always talking about the fact that it wasn't a fad, that it was there was a great defensiveness about organic. Organic in the nutrition profession was considered to be a fad, and I actually once testified for the Attorney General, who was doing a hearing in New York on organic on health food store fraud. And I was asked if I would testify, and I knew it was a poisonous thing to be asked to do in those days. I mean, really toxic, because, you know, Bob Rodale, who I really loved, by the way, was going to testify. And I knew that I would be, you know, I was like being attached to the dangerous people, you know. So I really, really worked on what I wrote. And I wrote about the fact that there were lots of organic farmers selling into the regular market. They weren't even making an extra profit. And that it was not, you know, it was not some terrible thing, that they were just trying to grow better and so forth and so on. And I ended up saying that I respected the person who was willing to pay a little more for organic more than I respected the person who went to the market to get cut up carrots frozen in butter and so forth. Anyway, so I testified. I won't go into the whole thing. The Attorney General, when I started to testify, said to me, would I cut it down because everything was running late? I got on late, right? And I started out by saying that I thought that it was very unfair to do something. And he was talking to somebody else when I started testifying, and he heard me say unfair. He said, who is unfair? And it was Lefkowitz. And he was like, you know, and I said, you. And oh, he listened to every single word I said. So the next morning, my picture was in the paper in the New York Times. And the headline was, Nutritionist Defends Faddists.
Wow.
So that's where you were, you know.
I've heard from a number of the academics, people from academia, who first went over to organic, that it was incredibly dangerous thing to do for their career.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. definitely dangerous. I mean, I was definitely called a faddist by the chairman of our department, who unfortunately only was chairman briefly, and I followed her as chair, but she said that one of the rather famous nutritionists in the field had said I was obviously a faddist.
And what does that mean? In other words, what was dangerous about what you were saying?
This is the thing. This is probably the secret of my whole career, Dave. I had worked for Time magazine. I knew a fact from a non-fact. I had to put a black dot over every word that the writer wrote as a researcher, and a red dot if it was a capitalized word, like it had to come from the Encyclopedia Britannica or Jane's Book of Ships or something, some authoritative source that I had to guarantee it was true. So I knew what the truth was. I knew how to affect, and I knew that there was all this myth-making in the whole field of nutrition, because the truth is that they were calling faddists at that point. This was in the 60s, right? These young people were all going to health food stores and buying brown rice and all these good foods, which theoretically we wanted them to eat, right? But that was considered faddism. And I had a friend who actually wrote a cookbook for the Heart Association. And she wanted to use a recipe for something called Cornell bread. Cornell University, during the war, somebody at Cornell had developed a recipe for bread that had brewer's yeast and other things that enhanced its protein quality. It had, I think it also had, I can't remember. Anyway, it had ingredients in it to enhance its protein quality. And so she called Cornell and said, could she get the authentic original recipe for Cornell bread? And they said, oh, we don't recommend that anymore. It was for the war. Like, we didn't have to have healthy food anymore. And she said, and they said, because you have to go to a health food store to get some of the ingredients. It was like totally mythological. It was like totally... Of course there were people who believed in crap. There are people who believe in crap now. There are people who believe if you take a particular token of something, it'll make you well. But there were a lot of people who just felt that the American food supply was like crappy and that they wanted to eat good food. And so they were eating whole foods. They were eating brown rice and, you know, whatever, in order to be more healthy. And the nutrition program simply couldn't, I mean, nutrition... At that point, I mean, I'm famous for, I guess my students now tell me I'm the one who made this up. I talked about nutrition was about everything that happened after the swallow. It didn't matter what happened before the swallow, just what happened after the swallow. It had my students, I had a student who did a dissertation on the sort of the history of the nutrition program at Teachers College, which is the oldest in the United States. And she found out that the students... My early students, many of them thought I was crazy, that I was telling them to learn about agriculture. Why would I get them to learn about agriculture, for God's sake? Why would anybody need to know about agriculture if you're interested in food, right? So my husband was on the board of Friends of the Earth, and I had read Paul Ehrlich's population bomb, and I was concerned about world hunger, and I was concerned about in the environment. And I came into the field that way, and I brought those things with me. And as I began to teach, which I was asked to help teach early, somebody else's course, I kept paying attention to these different things, like soil erosion and, you know, water pollution and air pollution and all these things. And I kept, and in the summer, I would sit down, and I had a huge dining room table, and I would sort out all the clippings I had saved from magazines and newspapers and anything I was reading. And I would say, why do these go together? You know, how does this happen to, what am I looking at? One day I had the revelation that I had been saving things on soil pollution, air and whatever, soil erosion. And I said, oh, I know, it's all agri-inputs. That was the overtitle, agri-inputs. And I made a whole series of categories. And so I developed the course sort of out of just looking widely and saying, how does this all fit together? And so gradually I evolved this course. And I didn't have organic in it right away. It didn't have agriculture in it right away, I don't think. I don't even remember how it first started. It started with limits to growth and food and population. Yeah. Those were the two topics that started it.
So I don't think that the question will end there, but let's start with, why do you think that agriculture needs to be part of a serious, mature conversation about nutrition?
Oh, because it's obvious that we've missed the whole boat. I mean, I don't know if you know this. Every single study that has been done using a nutrients or combination of nutrients in a controlled study, looking at whether they had, you know, if you give people extra vitamin C or vitamin A or C and A or A and D or whatever combination, E, there's been no effect of any of
it. Never works.
It never works. And we keep doing the studies to see whether it'll make a difference if you use excess, because nutrients was where it was at. It was at nutrients. And Michael Pollan who actually did the research and found out that the FDA finally, we used to have something called a recipe for foods that you couldn't, if you were going to put out pudding or something, it had a recipe, and if you were going to put on it, and if you didn't use that recipe, meaning it had to have cream and eggs and whatever, if you didn't use that recipe, it was called imitation. Well, you can imagine how much the food industry loved the word imitation, so they did everything they could to get rid of it, and they got rid of it. And the minute they got rid of it, all bets were off. You could take any piece of crap, and you could fortify it with nutrients, and you could call it nutritious.
Yes, because you've added the vitamins that the tests show
right.
don't have the desired effect.
But the fact of the matter is that if we don't go back to food, which means going back to agriculture, I mean, we have to go back to the beginning. If we don't go back to food, we're trapped in this ridiculous thing where, you know, sugar puffs fortified with B12, whatever.
So why do you think it is? How would you explain this to a civilian that taking these things that we have learned from tests of seeing what people eat, and we go that this seems to have a healthy outcome. If we figure out how to isolate it and add it to food, it doesn't have a healthy outcome. Am I getting that right?
Well, you have to understand the nature of the study. Number one, you have to understand nutrition is a very small, very badly funded profession up against the largest industry in the United States. The food industry is the largest industry in the United States. So with the funding, the government funding usually goes to land-grant colleges. So you get studies like people who eat breakfast cereal are getting more, get better nutrition, quote, for the nutrients for breakfast than people who are eating other things, okay? Because they have all this fortification, so they're getting more nutrients. They're not healthier. For one thing, I mean, studies looking at whether people are healthier are so expensive. I mean, you have to look at so long-term at cancer and heart disease and all these kinds of things. It's very expensive to run such a controlled study. So they're not done. And I remember one time I was testifying somewhere about, or I was writing or doing something about breakfast cereals, and I looked into the whole question of breakfast cereals, and I realized that we had all these added nutrients, but what about the original? Was there anything left? In other words, when you had the original cereal and you made the cereal, what were you adding these nutrients into? And one of the company president said something. Oh, there's nothing left. I mean, there's no nutrients left from the original grain. It's all what we've added.
Also, all the flavors have been added.
Right, of course. Of course, all the sugar.
Yeah. So you feel fairly confident that adding nutrition to food-like substances is not actually giving the desired outcome for human nutrition.
All you have to do is look at our health statistics. I mean, look at our health statistics. I mean, here we are, one of the richest countries in the world, and we have terrible health statistics. I mean, life expectancy for males, and you know, we have better. It looks better if you start at birth we don't look so bad because we have all these emergency things to take care of premature children. So we keep a lot of kids who are not very healthy when they're born alive. So we have better health statistics. But if you look at the longevity of the 21-year-old male in the United States compared to other countries, I mean, we're below Greece. We're below, I mean, we're below lots of countries people wouldn't believe were below. We have terrible health. We have a terrible health set of health statistics. And in fact, it's hilarious because I just read recently, I don't remember where. Does anyone remember where they read anything these days? I don't remember where, but I read that the government has just decided they should study the nutritional effects of processed foods. Right. It's a little late, but they're starting now. I mean, I can remember 25 years ago, probably the FDA put out a series of questions they needed answered. And one of like 57 questions was, what are the nutritional effects of processing? And there are now people like Montiero in Spain who has come up with this idea of ultra processing. And 60% of American foods are now ultra-processed, and I don't know if you know what that means, but he has foods, processed foods, and ultra-processed foods, and foods are what you think they are. Processed foods are like bread and canned tomatoes and stuff like that. Ultra-processed foods are made from ingredients. They're not even made... They might have some what we would call processed foods as part of their ingredients, but basically they're made, you know, from isolated soy, isolated whatever, and they're manufactured in a factory, you know, and 60%. We don't have any idea what that means.
Yeah. We are the guinea pigs in this experiment.
We are the guinea pigs. And of course, I have to bring up, just for, because it's such a big thing in organic, this whole thing about hydroponics in organic is just a joke. I mean, it's a joke. I can't see how it would possibly got approved because it's all, I mean, the reason organic is so precious is because it's listening to nature and saying, okay, what is nature doing down there? And whatever nature's doing, she knows how to keep it going over the long term. And that's what we probably ought to be listening to, right?
Yes, yes. So this is a huge, huge issue that you brought up. It's a huge question. I've had many people who said, I always buy organic food. I support the organic movement. I don't understand this thing about hydroponics. And I thought, well, that's because you don't really understand what organic means. But that's fine. So let's find, these are people of goodwill. They have good intentions. So how do you explain that? Like, what is wrong? What wrong isn't the right word. Why isn't hydroponic? Can't it be organic? What does organic mean that hydroponic couldn't be?
There's so much going on in the soil, as we now know. I mean, we now know there's a human biome. All these years we've been trying to knock out every single bacteria we found in our bodies, kill them all off. And we've discovered, after we take antibiotics, that our gut is in terrible shape and we have to re-put in probiotics in order to get back into shape. Well, the same thing is true in the soil, and we now know that. We're just learning it. I mean, we're very new at it. I have a favorite story I used to tell about growing sweet potatoes and discovering accidentally, I mean, I rebuilt my garden because I was being flooded all the time. And so I raised it 2 feet and I brought in some pretty terrible stuff that had a lot of clay in it. And there were two beds that had nothing planted in them. And I had been brought a lot of wonderful compost. And so many of the beds had a lot of compost pretty much on the surface, but it could be dug in. But these beds had nothing. And Fred came over with a pickaxe to break one of them open for me. And I thought, what am I going to do with this? You know, I'm a gardener. I can't just have this bed of clay sitting here. So I thought, well, I think I'll plant sweet potatoes because I'd grown them in other places and they seem to be pretty tolerant of everything. And I knew they made these beautiful vines. And I thought, at least they'll cover this bed with vines, whatever happens. So I planted them into this really terrible soil. And when the fall came, I thought, well, I had vines. I had wonderful vines, but I had no idea whether there was anything down there. And I dug, and there was a whole crop of sweet potatoes. But the soil was totally transformed. I mean, the soil was suddenly soil. It wasn't clay anymore. I went around and tried to find out why. Do you know about this? I mean, you know all about this? Okay.
Tell me.
We had a farmer from Germany. I'm on a Rockland Farm Alliance group that has a farm here in the county. And the farmer was from Germany, and he said, oh, that's glomalin. I said, really? What is that? And he sent me a pamphlet. And it explains that the glomalis, which are the organisms in the soil, I can't remember the family they're in. It'll come to me, but I can't remember at the moment. And that in response to the sugar they get from the roots of the plants, the plants give those big roots are busy sort of sending sugar into the soil, and the organisms absorb the sugar, and in return they put out this substance called glomalin, which ties the soil together. It binds together the little bits of, you know, that's what the trouble is with clay. It's these tiny particles. And it also recruits various nutrients and so forth and so on. And it was thought of as a contaminant in the soil by the USDA. And he sent me this pamphlet, which came out, I think, well, let me say 96. It was probably 96. Saying that we couldn't be farming without it. If we had accidentally, if DDT or something else had accidentally killed off I'm trying to think of the class of organisms, so the name is escaping me. It'll come to me. But if we'd kill them off, which we could have, I mean, you know, what we're dumping on the soil, we don't know what it's doing, right?
Yes.
We would have killed it off, and we would have changed everything.
Yeah.
And it was like this revelation to me. I thought I was putting organic matter in the soil, I don't know, somehow to change the texture and probably provide a little nitrogen. I didn't know I was feeding the organisms. And that's the revelation, that organic agriculture is feeding the organisms in the soil so that the organisms in the soil can produce, can feed the plants in return. And that's how we get to why we don't have to add a lot of fertilizer and external inputs and all that.
Will Brinton once said to me that the really interesting thing is in the 80-some years since Albert and Louise Howard did their work, that science, soil science and nutrition, have mostly confirmed their observations, saying, yes, but what we now have is much better explanations for why those observations are true. And I thought that was a very nice way of putting it. I don't think that they had coined the word glomalin back when Albert Howard was doing his work, but now we have a better, not a great understanding, but a better understanding.
Well, there's one of the revelatory books for me was a book called, I think it's called Tales from the Underground or Notes from the Underground by a guy from Cornell, which was all about all this activity going on in the soil. And it was like such a revelation. I mean, that we can't, It's really hard to go into the laboratory and try to test anything because everybody's working together. I mean, it's all a whole system. It's not just one organism. It's a whole series of organisms, each of them feeding the others. And I mean, when you really realize, it's when I stopped digging much. I love to dig, but I stopped doing much digging because I didn't want to disturb the soil organisms, you know?
Yeah. I had an aha moment the other night where I thought soil is not a noun, it's a verb.
Great.
Isn't that nice? It's really, it was something that my wife was reading about a Native American language, and they had very few nouns and a great many verbs. And I thought, oh yeah, it really made sense. It's a process, it's a community. And
unfortunately, the only verb that we use soil for is to get dirty.
Yeah.
I soiled myself.
Yes. Right. Well, we're trying to celebrate getting dirty a little more. I one of the things I thought about you, Joan, is that you're not unique, but let's say unusual in being an academic who has had dirty hands much of her life, that you've worked in the soil.
the mayor of the town. I used to be on the board in the town, and I used to sit next to the mayor. I was on the board of trustees, and one time something came up, and he said, "Oh, is that why your fingernails are always dirty, Jones?" And I was embarrassed. They are. It's just impossible. You know, it's and I wear clothes. Yeah.
So I wanted to point one thing out for people who are listening, which is when you talked about feeding that soil life with sugars, those sugars are coming from the plants, from photosynthesis. And so it's I know you know this, it's a great deal that they work together. You can't really have a healthy soil without plants, and you can't really have healthy plants without a soil.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I'm looking at the poster that's behind you. I must say, it's a wonderful poster.
Yeah, that was April's, but we're writing again.
That was the conference we were going to have.
That was this conference we were going to have. We're going to use the same poster. We're just going to change the dates and a few pictures. It will be exciting. So,
can I ask you a question? I know this
sure,
is your.
John.
Do you have any sense that USDA is going to back down on hydroponic?
They swear they won't, and I believe them. You know,
If we get a new president, do you think that might change things?
Well, I suspect everything will be better for organic under Biden than under Trump. It will be, for sure. But I think it probably would have taken somebody like Bernie to actually turn the National Organic Program, honestly. The current director of the National Organic Program insists over and over that this is a settled issue. And she's pretty good at ignoring the fact that over half the people in the room don't think it's a settled issue. So I don't think it's a settled issue. I'm involved in a lawsuit suing them because I think the law, the Organic Food Production Act, pretty clearly says organic must maintain and improve the fertility of the soil.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's what the law says. Well, I remember when I was on the National Organic Standards Board, we were dealing with the issue of synthetics and processing.
Yeah.
I kept pointing out, I mean, as you know, things in the Federal Register are written in such a way that you cannot follow them through. So I spent a lot of time rewriting that so I could understand this subtitle came under, this subtitle came under, and this meant this, which is takes time to do. And I just kept fighting them over and over. I mean, and of course the blueberry farmer actually won because it was true. It did say you couldn't use synthetics in processing, but they kept claiming that it didn't say that.
Yeah, no, Arthur Harvey did win that lawsuit amazingly.
And then of course Congress changed it right away. Right?
It changed it. And it was dirty business. They changed it in a midnight rider. They did it when all the opponents were out of the room. It was very unpleasant exercise of, I would say, a corrupt power in our government. But this is what we all deal with, and we lose a lot, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep going. So I'm happy to talk politics, but I'd love to go in a little bit deeper on nutrition and soil just to understand. One of the things that's interesting to me is the difficulty, as you say, of studying complex systems. You can't isolate them and get a meaningful understanding. So how does that, do you think that perspective is growing in soil science and nutritional science?
You mean modesty at what they can find out? Probably not. It's interesting, you know, you may not know this, but the only way we realized, I think it was cancer, that cancer had a nutritional component was what happened when the Japanese came from Japan and moved to California, and their cancer rates went up. And then the second, in other words, when they moved to Hawaii, I guess they moved to Hawaii, and then they moved to California, what happened was the diet changed, and the rates of cancer changed. And so suddenly people said, oh my goodness, that, you know, whole diets have something to do with all this. And the other thing is that it's a perfect demonstration. We know, I was on the diet and cancer panel, and so when they wrote up the results, they would keep writing, people who have higher levels of vitamin C have less cancer. And I would write, I would change it. People who eat foods with higher levels, because that's all we knew. I mean, really, it is all we knew. We only knew because the evidence on broccoli and cruciferous vegetables and cancer came from countries, Scandinavian countries, where people ate much higher levels of cruciferous and they had lower levels of cancer. And so that's what we knew. We knew that people who ate vegetables of a certain sort, but they put it in terms of, they kept writing it up as if it was nutrients. They couldn't get out of that. And I can remember being on the diet and cancer panel, which is itself a story. I was the only woman, and I came the first day in beach clothes and to all these men in three-piece suits, and it was like, it was not the greatest. I won them over, but it took a while. But anyway, there was a guy there who was an expert in, oh God, I'm not going to remember the name of the compound. It's a compound that's in broccoli and in the cruciferous vegetables. It's not of one of the nutrients. It's another compound. And he was known for having discovered this and that this was the thing. And I said to him, how do you know it's not vitamin C? And he said, I think I said vitamin C. He said, well, there's no vitamin C in broccoli. I said, yes, there is. I mean, the separation between the silos they lived in, where they were so separated from everything else. I mean, I changed a lot of minds on that panel, I must say, because I kept making the point that they didn't, in the epidemiologic studies, when they studied whole populations, they didn't know what they were looking at. They were looking at a whole diet, and they said, oh, look, this diet is higher in B12. Well, why B12? What about some of these other things? It's also higher in. What about all those non-nutritive substances that we now know are important, that it's full of? How do we know it's not that? Why are you picking this one nutrient out of this diet? And it was very, very upsetting to them because it made it very hard to come to conclusions. You know, you can only, in science, you have to control everything, and you can't really control food, right? Food is elusive. It's all those thousands of compounds interacting with all those thousands of compounds in your body. And we're saying, oh, because you have B12, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, we do have some specific deficiency diseases, but that's about all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you think that we will get a new understanding, a deeper understanding, and that we will start to study food as a system, both in agriculture, how it's grown, but also in the mixture of diet and what we eat? Or is that just too darn hard?
That's such a great question, Dave, because there's this guy named Monteiro who talks about ultra processing. There's somebody else whose name, I'm sorry, I can't remember, who's talking about matrix and about the fact that an orange and orange juice are different because you've changed the matrix. In other words, you're getting the nutrient at a different rate in a different substance underlying it. You know, somehow it's hitting the body in a different way.
Love that.
I do too. I mean, I have a friend who's gone crazy about the whole idea of the matrix, but how we could pay no attention to that always sort of astonishes me. Like the idea that Tang is just the same as orange juice, except we found out orange juice has folate in it, so we'll put some folate in the Tang, so now it'll still be the same. Will it happen? I don't know. I can't. It's people need to have, I guess, people need to feel they know something, a lot about something. And so if you know nutrients, you know, and what they do and where they operate in the body and all that. That's like a whole set of knowledge that you have. And the fact that it's probably useless in some ways, except in a large generic sense, you know, except it's, you know, deficiency diseases were interesting and we, you know, there are such things and they still exist. Yeah. People still have goiter in other parts of the world where there isn't any iodine in the plant life and in the whatever. But they're the minor part of the whole nutritional issue. I mean, our nutritional issues are not shortages of things anymore. They're excesses of things, too much fat, too much saturated fat, too much complex carb, non-complex carbohydrate, simple carbohydrate. Yeah. Too much, a bad relationship. And it's just that we're not eating foods. You know, we're not, I joke about my own diet. I said, two from column A and two from column B. We're supposed to have so many, whatever, you know, the four food groups. Now it's whatever. It used to be seven, went to four. Now we have my plate. We have all these different ways of talking about using food. But they never, You cannot, just as in organic, Dave, you got the big guys out there and they're not going to let it happen.
Yes.
You know,
so the big guys are a problem in life for all of us, you know, because the big guys make their money off of persuading us to buy what they do, whatever it is. And one of the things I've seen, it's not necessarily a causality, but it's certainly a correlation, which is, as our food has gotten cheaper and cheaper, our healthcare costs have gone up higher and higher.
Yes.
And the health outcomes are not going up along with the healthcare costs.
I have a couple of funny stories to tell. One is when the LISA program was first set up. Remember Low Input Sustainable Agriculture? I think it was set up, in the 60s, 70s? I don't remember. No, probably later than that. I went to a meeting not long afterward. And somebody in the meeting said that they were changing the name to Sustainable Agriculture, you know, whatever it is now, Sustainable Education and whatever. What's it called now? I can't even remember. Anyway, they changed the name.
Yes.
And they changed the name for two reasons. One is that it was meant low input. Nobody wanted low-input agriculture. I mean, the farmers did, but nobody selling them stuff wanted low-input agriculture. And also, it had a feminine acronym, LISA, which was very bad in farming. Very bad.
Yeah.
You did not want a feminine acronym.
Yeah.
And the other piece is that in food, what you want... There's a limit to population growth, and if you're going to if you have to grow, if industry, if capitalism says you have to grow, I mean, I was at a board meeting at one of the big food companies one time, and we talked about this. They have to grow. That's how capitalism works. Well, if you have a fairly fixed population size, and our population is not growing fast anymore, it really isn't. And what are you going to do? How do you get people to buy more except by getting them fat? Well, we did that. We've done that. So we now have everybody's now fat.
Unfortunately, the truth is that I think the same corporations that have made a great living out of making us overweight and malnourished are looking at the rest of the world.
Oh, they absolutely are. Oh, they're absolutely. The times
and they're being quite, you know, we see that weights are going up around the world.
That's right. And there are more overweight people than there are hungry people, underweight people now.
It's amazing. Yes.
But the thing I never got to was the fact that how you do it is you get people to pay more money for less actual food. That is, if you make this thing, you know, you make some sort of ice pop out of juice with more water than anything else, and you sell it for three times as much money, you make a lot of money. And so, and in fact, that was the advice that was, it's in the Feeding Web, my book, the advice that was given to the food industry was to get as far as possible from the original food ingredients because they could go up and down. The price of those varied according to availability and so forth. But the further you could get away from using it, the more reliable your profits would be.
That's, I never thought of that, but that's dismaying, but quite interesting. So, well, I'd like to go to that, but before, you were talking about in different places, you have to look at how things are done. One of the pieces of research that came out, I think last year, was a long study done in France, and they were showing that based on what people ate, people who ate a primarily organic diet had a statistically significantly reduced rate of cancer. And it was taken as, that's wonderful. And I had to ask the question, but that's a French organic diet. And that is not the same as an American organic diet, because what organic means in America includes hydroponics and includes CAFOs. We haven't talked about CAFOs yet.
I couldn't believe. When I saw that, I thought, no, it's, that's like...
So for people who don't know what a CAFO is, could you start there and talk about why that wouldn't be called
what
organic?
What it means, to start with, is it means confined animal feeding operation. So it means the animals are confined, and where you used to have a bunch of cattle in a barn, and they'd go out during the day, and they'd graze, and they'd go back to the barn, you now have them in the barn, so to speak. Or actually, with cattle, you don't. It's hogs that have ended up in the barn all day. The cattle are out in feedlots, where they're standing in their own manure and crowded into feedlots and being fed organic corn in order to make them organic, right?
Yes.
But they're horrible. I mean, they're really devastating. And of course, they're located in places where Black people live. I mean, need I say any more than that? Of course they are. And the story we've used in my class, we've used a number of articles about like North Carolina and places like that, where there are all these hog barns. And when it floods, they all overflowed and dead pigs floated around and pig manure floated around and the manure collects. The pigs are all confined in this metal shed, very crowded, with wooden floors through which their shit falls into a bin, and then it's all sort of let out, floats out, or it's cleaned out into a pond, and they have these giant waste ponds of hog shit, and it smells, well, need I tell you it what it smells like? And there are people who live just downwind of it, and who have tried to sue. And the states have not really helped them, because the states are making a lot of money from these things. And these people, when the lagoons get full, they take the stuff out and they spray it on the fields as fertilizer. And can you imagine living next to a place that is spraying hog shit? I mean, people don't go out of doors. They can't move out. They keep their windows closed. And since they're poor, of course, they don't have air conditioning. I mean, it's really brutal to the animals and to the people around them. And the only purpose, and of course, we now know what happens to them when there is a breakdown, as there has been now. They've had to kill off a lot of these animals because the slaughterhouses were overloaded, and they had so much COVID in the slaughterhouses that the workers had to stay home and they couldn't slaughter the pigs. And then the president announced that it was an essential activity. And so they had to go to work. And so, you know, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these places are
part of that class of work that, by and large, you can no longer hire U.S. citizens to do. They just won't do it.
Right.
And so you bring in guest workers or undocumented workers who do not have protection of the law, are treated terribly, or paid terribly. You know, the whole thing is a terrible spiral. And for me, it's very poignant, because sometimes I've heard the discussion that organic is somehow organic. That's okay. Organic is somehow the food of the elites. And, I find that so upsetting, because of course the people who own all these mega agribusinesses, they're elite. They're very wealthy people, But the reason that the food
who
that comes
feed
out
their
of those,
families organic, by the way, those people aren't yes. eating the meat from their own. You can be sure they're not eating the meat from their own thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. But the reason that it's so cheap is because the animals are treated as if they were widgets in a factory, and the workers are treated as if they're widgets in a factory, so it's a pretty broken system. One of the things that I see, I have a friend who's a labor historian, and she told me about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in the Lower East Side of New York. It happened about 100 years ago, and it was they made shirtwaists at this Triangle factory, and they had terrible working conditions, and there was a fire, and many people died. They couldn't get out.
And the doors were locked, as I recall, weren't they?
What's that?
The doors were locked.
The doors were locked. Yes, absolutely. OSHA would not have approved on so many levels, and we can be grateful that by and large our workplaces are vastly safer because we have laws to protect workers here. However, most of our clothing is no longer made in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's made in, you know, Bangladesh. And guess what? They have exactly the same fires and the same horrible work conditions, and people are dying. There's 600 fires a year in which people are dying in these little factories. And what happened 100 years ago in Manhattan is that this became a major news story, and it started the American labor movement and took it to a new level. And it started unionization, and it started OSHA, it started worker safety. It really started a lot of great things for, you know, as a result of those poor people dying. And what happens now when somebody in Sri Lanka, or many people in Sri Lanka, die, is that there is no response because we're the market. You know, the market is here. So I'm thinking that the same kind of thing is happening with much of agriculture right now, where it's produced far away. The market is in the city.
And yes, exactly.
Has no appreciation of the pain of living next to a CAFO, let alone what it means to the animals that live there.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Except that's, I think, one of the gifts of COVID is that I do think, at least here in the Northeast, I think there's been a lot of, we've been putting together our course for this year, and we have a session on local, and we have several sessions on agriculture. But one of the things that's happened is there's been a lot of understanding on people's part that they suddenly can't get something. Why can't they get something? They had no idea about these supply chains. And people have suddenly learned what a supply chain is, and they've begun to learn, because they've now learned that all these workers in these factories are getting COVID, and I think there, at least among some people, there's been a real awakening of the horrors of our present food system, some of the things that are wrong with it.
Yeah. If we can grow that understanding and turn it into a movement. So that's, of course, what the Real Organic Project is trying to do.
Yes.
And what do you think? Is there a chance there?
I'll have to tell you that probably the most discouraging thing I've come across in our field in a long time was one of the speakers at your last symposium, I think it was, who talked about the distribution system in the middle.
Yes, Alan Lewis's talk.
Oh, boy, that was really depressing, because he said, you know, you can have a guy growing great tomatoes next door to you, and you can't get his tomatoes into your store because it's not part of the distribution system. There's only like two distributors left in the organic thing. That's and will they care whether it says real organic or not? Probably not. So that depresses me. I grew up in the Great Depression. I've seen terrible things in this country. I'm just fundamentally an optimist. I can't help myself. I just basically am a person who I've been denounced by people, by the males in my field when I was first getting started and making all these rousing speeches about what was wrong with the food supply and how we were killing the population, et cetera, et cetera. And I was told, how could I dare depress students so much? I said, you mean by telling them the truth? I'm depressed. I'm not supposed to tell them the truth. So I tend to tell the truth. And I did grow up under Franklin Roosevelt, who was my only president until I was in high school, when I was in study hall and the chemistry teacher was running the study hall and she liked me and she called me up to her desk. The flag had just gone to half mast and I went up to her desk. She said, Franklin Roosevelt just died. And I remember that. Like, my God, he was the only president we ever knew. But he did it. And it just was reading something today about people pushing Joe Biden to be another Franklin Roosevelt. And he likes the idea. He increasingly likes the idea. I mean, obviously, we have to change the whole economic. I mean, we can't have five people in the country owning half of the country's wealth. We can't have that. I mean, it doesn't work. It just, you know, there's no middle. The middle class is like, there's an upper middle class, which has sort of gained some in the last few months, last few years. But the rest of us have not gained anything at all. Yeah. So it can't go on. So do I believe that maybe someone will take it in hand, and if we get Mitch McConnell out of the Senate, we'll finally pass legislation and raise taxes on the very wealthy and get enough money to do what needs to be done and cut the corporations down to size? I mean, the corporations in agriculture, the concentration is just frightening. And that's why we're all so helpless, because they're so huge. They just go and they send a few million bucks to Congress and tell people to vote this way, and they do. I mean, the whole relief package that was passed was so corrupted, apparently, by the guys who got in there first and got these little things they'd always wanted into that bill. So it's, yes, but am I an optimist? I have to be. I mean, what am I going to do? I mean, I'm not going to be here to see it happen anyways, so I just have to hope for the rest of you that it changes. You know, I'm not going to be around forever.
Yeah, well, you're an optimist, but you're also an activist. You have not stopped speaking out and fighting for what it is that you think that we need to do. And I think, you know, I know for many people, just people who know you, you're an inspiring model. I think that I'm amazed at what it is that takes for us to act. And we go, yeah, in food is a very clear example. We read about CAFOs. Most people have never been to one. And we read about this and that, but where's the action? It's hard to organize people.
Well, it's interesting that Cory Booker, of all people, from New Jersey, right, which is not exactly CAFO country, he's put in a bill to stop CAFOs and phase them out by, what, 2030 or something? I mean, he really is serious about it.
That would be spectacular. I read in Jonathan Safran Foer's book that at the moment, our meat, milk, and eggs come from 99.9% come from CAFOs. It's really massive at this point. And certainly in organic, we're seeing in eggs and poultry, it's already completely taken over. In dairy, it's probably about half CAFOs. And it's against the rules. It's nobody in the organic movement supports it. There are plenty of people in Congress who support it. There are plenty of people in the USDA who support it. But it's fascinating to me. I come in this conversation truly as a naive farmer. And, you know, really, I just farmed and raised my kids. I didn't go to meetings. And then I started learning about this stuff, and I got worked up.
The first time I learned about CAFOs, I don't know, I read something about corporate hogs. I think it was from, I can't remember who I was following in the Midwest, but they had all this stuff about the beginnings of them. And this was a long time. It was not a long time ago. 30 years ago, I guess, started, right? 30, 40 years ago is the most. They started this consolidation of getting, all farmers had hogs. And it was how they made money on bad years. They fed the leftover grains they couldn't sell to the hogs, and they sold the hogs. That's how farmers stayed in business. And I read about the corporate hogs, and I stopped eating meat except for a hamburger on Friday. That was I thought my 1/4 pound of beef is not causing those CAFOs. And then I found farmers nearby that I could buy from. And so now I buy from a farmer whose cattle I've stood in the barn with. But I don't see how people eat that meat. I mean, my son once offered me pork from Walmart. I said, I'm not going to eat pork from Walmart. I mean, I'm not going to eat pork from Walmart. I can't.
Yeah.
I just can't. But I can't. So that's what I try to do. I try to make people realize what they're eating.
Yes.
I mean, really, is that what you really want to eat?
Do you think that the Real Organic Project could grow to the point where it could actually give people that choice? Because the problem I see right now, I always buy organic in the store. What else am I going to buy? But right. I know that I also can't trust that. And yeah. But I do care about what I eat, and I will support the people who are growing food in a way that I support, you know, that I believe in. I'll support them financially if I can figure out how to.
Yes, well, that's part of the problem. I do. I'm lucky in that there's a milk called Natural by Nature that is sold in my health food store, and that gets the Cornucopia does these scorecards, and it gets a very, very high mark on their scorecard. So I'm very pleased about that, and I get eggs from upstate farmers that deliver for a CSA that I'm part of. So
yeah,
I feel very comfortable with what I'm getting. And yeah. People say to me, doesn't it cost more? And I said, I suppose so. I mean, come on, I don't eat that much meat. You know, that's
right.
I don't eat half-pound steaks or whatever. But
yeah, well, it's cheaper than going to the hospital, isn't it?
It's a hell of a lot cheaper than going to the hospital. Yes, that's for sure. Well, I guess the thing I can really say is I'm never sick. Knock wood on that, but I don't get sick. A lot of people were very worried about coming to visit me, even to socially distance on my terrace because they're afraid of killing me at 91, you know? And I said, you know, I'm very tough. I don't get sick. And I don't. People know that. I just don't get sick. And I swear it has something to do with the fact that I just eat food. And I'm not, despite what people may believe in the fact that I grow so much, I'm not a huge salad eater or a greens eater. I'm really not. I eat, you know, I pretty much eat vegetables that I grow, but it's, you know, sugar snap peas if I have them, and carrots, a lot of carrots. There are a lot of carrots in my diet. And winter vegetables.
Great.
In the winter.
Well, I should be somewhat responsible and call this a wrap. Joan, thank you very much. And as I said, and I now know, we'll have to do it again because we didn't get to half of it. But This would be great. So thank you very
much. Thank you, Dave. It's been wonderful. It's been fun to talk with you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. We hope that you like what you heard today and will subscribe to our podcast, tell your friends about it, and leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you found us. A video version of this interview, as well as the full transcript with links related to today's conversation, is found at realorganicproject.org/episode10. Please join us next time for an interview with renowned blogger, educator, and author Seth Godin. His marketing books include Purple Cow, Tribes, and All Marketers Are Liars. Seth believes that real change happens through stories. To find a real organic farm near you, visit realorganicproject.org/farms.